All right, what is going on, everybody? Welcome back to SaberSims DFS Office Hours. It is Friday, April 29th of 2022 here. Thanks for tuning into the stream today. If this is your first time watching Office Hours, my name's Jordan. I'm the head coach here at SaberSim. And this is an open Q&A style show where I answer questions from our community about how to better use SaberSim, about overall DFS strategy, really whatever you guys want to talk about. You can throw your questions into YouTube chat, into the Office Hours channel in Slack, and we'll answer questions in roughly the order they come in. I always try to prioritize the questions from Slack first, just to prioritize those questions coming directly from our community, but answer the questions in about the order that they come in. We've got a few interesting questions in our queue here for today already. I see a question about bottom of the order hitters in baseball stacks, so we'll talk a little bit about that. Interesting conversation ongoing in Slack as well about the lineup pool on SaberSim and pulling your lineups directly from the full pool of your lineups. I think it's kind of also a question about SaberScore in disguise a little bit there as well. So we'll talk a little bit about that. Obviously tackle everything else that comes in as well. If you haven't already joined Slack, before we get started here, definitely recommend doing that. There is a link to join in the description of every past Office Hours video. So I mentioned before, you get that kind of priority queue for your questions to be answered on this stream. But you also get access to the Sim Alerts channels that will let you know when Sims are running for different sports, and access to our free prop bets of the day that we have been doing for basketball and baseball every single day. We are, you know, I keep saying that I'm going to do this. I'll have to pull up the actual numbers here. I know very profitable on both since the start of the year. Maybe if we have a little time towards the end of the show, I can pull up the actual numbers and see where we stand here. Last time I checked, I think we were plus 120 units on just the free bets for our NBA bets since the start of the season. So you might as well be taking advantage of that, getting to Slack, get access to that free bet of the day as well. So let's go ahead. Let's get started here. We'll get the app pulled up and dive in. Friday night baseball slates are always a lot of fun. Definitely some of the biggest slates of the week. I think Fridays and Tuesdays have a lot of the games. Pretty good contest sizing here on these end of the week slates. So cool. Okay, so this is a question from Danny. Let's get started here. About these bottom of the order hitters and stacks. He said, correlation question. A five-man stack on any night going ham. You look and four bats are cooking. The last bat is the bottom of the order, battering around 157, just hoping for a hit by pitch or walk. He's correlated to the team, but not so much in win equity. How would you avoid, or would you just let it go and hope he luck boxes a home run against a reliever? Personally, I feel like the bottom of the order, 7 through 9, is normally for slumps or breaks. So I try to keep it to only good bats who are in that 7 and 9 that are normally higher. The problem is that pricing doesn't usually adjust much for order. Yeah, interesting question here. And one that I think is actually a really big challenge to overcome if you're building lineups by hand or building lineups with the traditional optimizer, right? How do you, you know, there's batting order is going to be taken into account a little bit when it comes to the overall average projection, but it's difficult to know, you know, how much you essentially want to weight correlation, right? That's what this question's really asking is when you've got, you know, if you've got the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 hitters, and maybe because of pricing or positional constraints, the next best hitter you can stack in there is the 8 hitter, right? Who, exactly as Danny said here, is correlated to the rest of the stack, but probably not the best overall point per dollar play that could be used in that lineup position. So do you sacrifice the correlation and play the better player, the better projected player, or do you build the stack out, right? I personally end up allowing the simulations themselves to answer this question for me in the vast majority of cases, right? That is essentially what the sliders combined with the simulation data, the correlation data, and the actual outcomes from the sims will answer for you. If you are getting a lineup, for example, so I'm going to take this to start with here. We'll use a 20 max, 10 to 50K, right? Default settings for tonight's 13-game slate. If you are getting a five-man stack where that last player is a 7, 8, 9-hole hitter, right, the builder is basically saying for that particular set of simulations used to build that lineup and the default settings for correlation for the contest you're playing, it does make sense to use that correlated player, even if that's a player that projects a little bit worse or maybe doesn't have home run hitting upside or is in a slump or any of these other things that can come into play. If you're getting a lineup that is a 4 stack, right, maybe it's a 4-3-1, right? That one-off player, that is the builder saying that in this case, it was better to use maybe that one-off slugger who's hitting great, who's a higher overall projected player that's completely uncorrelated to the rest of the lineup. That is literally the SaberSim builder kind of making these decisions dynamically on a slate-to-slate and lineup-to-lineup basis here. So if we look, right, let's go take an example, right? And we can actually even see right here, right? We're getting a ton of Miko Horner in the nine hole for the Cubs, right? That is why that is happening. That is saying, you know, based on the way that he correlates to the other hitters in the lineup, he's actually optimal to use despite his generally pretty low projection along with these other Cubs stacks most of the time, right? So for me personally, I don't worry about this too much. I allow SaberSim to kind of help guide me through this. And we can see here on a big 13-game slate, where correlation is going to be high and your sim variance is going to be a little bit lower, you're going to see it's generally going to prioritize playing that 5-3 stack or that 5-2 stack. On smaller slates, well, there's a 3-3-2. So on smaller slates, might be a little bit different. Here's a good one, a 5-2 stack, right? Where we've got Austin Hayes, who's in here, right? Decent projected hitter, can hit for a little bit of power. Are they still in New York? Now they're in Camden. Okay. Actually, not so much of a good park anymore, I guess, but decent hitting park maybe still. Anyway, the point I'm trying to make is not a correlated player to the rest of the lineup. So anyway, I don't normally think too much about this. I let SaberSim kind of handle when I'm going to be using lower batting order hitters in the stack, as opposed to some other better projected, less correlated player individually. So that's the way I handle it. If I were to research this a little bit further and dive in a little bit further, I do like the approach you've described here of going through and kind of cherry picking. And this could be a variety of different ways. This could be with a little bit of an eye test. This could be with maybe looking at just home run hitting upside or something like that. But I do like the idea of going through and kind of team by team checking on these 7, 8, 9 hole hitters, right? And just seeing if these are guys that you actually want to play. Like what do their higher scoring percentiles look like? What does their home run upside look like? I think can be an interesting thing to look at too. And maybe cherry picking some of your lineups there, right? We can see there's a big difference between a guy like Jeremy Pena, right? Hitting in the eight, projected in the 8-hole spot for the Astros, who has a 1 in 5 chance or hits, right, 0.19 home runs per simulation that we have compared to, Chris Owings, who has a, or, you know, Jorge Mateo, who has a 0.04 average home run upside. Not to say home runs are everything, and especially this season, maybe even looking at home run upside isn't the best way to go about it, just because home runs are down this year. And I think those upside guys are sometimes doing it a little bit different ways, extra base hits and stolen bases and things like that. But I do still think it's a decent parameter for determining when there's upside, right? Or when maybe you still want to play a guy, even if they're a 7, 8, 9 hole hitter. So, but with that said, I don't do that. I let the stacks, I almost all hitters are in my player pool that by default. If I get some lower order stacks in my pool, I'm totally fine with it. I have no issues with that. So, and the reason why is not just because I've decided to not worry about it. It's because since we're leveraging the correlation data and the simulation data every time we build a lineup, those decisions are kind of being made for you a bit here. It's something that SaberSim does a good job of simplifying. So. Cool. Let's jump ahead. All right. Interesting. Okay, so interesting question here. A lot going on in this one. So let's go ahead. We'll jump over here. This is from Andrew. He said, what are your thoughts on a random sampling approach to MLB GPPs? Making all your adjustments in step one, adjust for conclusions drawn from research builds, outside sources like weather, et cetera, building a 1500 lineup pool, checking or including all 1500 lineups in your build and unique random filling your contest with zero opinion in step three. I imagine this is a legitimate strategy if you can prove your pool is plus EV. And a second question is, how would you suggest analyzing your pool as a whole? My initial thoughts on the simplest approach is to compare top 1% equity of the actual scores in your pool versus the top 1% score cutoffs in various contests you play. This is an interesting idea. I have at least toyed with the idea of doing this here, mostly from the lens or from the standpoint of spreading out as much as possible, right? So, I mean, you can see even here, right? Here's a decent example. So for the 20 max set of lineups we just built, right? We have 60% Cubs exposure, right? That is a reflection of the Sabre score mostly here, is that, you know, we have all of these different lineups. We probably have a very diverse different pool here. We're getting 60% of our lineups in our top 20 as Cubs stacks, but Cubs are probably very unlikely to be 60% optimal in our larger pool of 500. Yeah, so we can see. So the Cubs actually only have an 8% chance of being the optimal lineup, at least according to this limited build, right? This isn't a true research build, but I think you get what I'm saying, right? The pool of lineups in your broader pool is always, always going to be much more diverse than your actual set of 20 or 150 you're playing from that pool. So if your goal was to match your exposures as closely to your broad research build as possible and play a really balanced strategy, I think there's some merit to the idea of just building a giant pool of 1,500 lineups and filling uniquely. Now, the problem with that, and I think probably the biggest issue that I see with that, is that SaberScore does actually have some value, right? If you are going to do that, you're also going to start accepting some smaller stack sizes into your pool. You're probably going to be accepting some much lower projected lineups into your pool. You might also be accepting some much chalkier lineups into your pool, right? SaberScore, the point of step three is not just to provide you a dynamic pool of lineups from which you can sort through. The goal of step three is also to build each lineup more than once so we have the better opportunity of identifying what the best one is to use. So by building your pool of 1,500 lineups and just saying, I'm going to randomly sample it, you are allowing probably some much lower lineups overall to enter into your pool. Now, I do think in general, you know, if you could build every single lineup out there that was possible on a slate, or even every single lineup that was possible over a certain salary limit and average projection, and then you took the top 1,500 lineups out and could mathematically quantify EV, the EV of those lineups would probably all be very similar. There would probably, I imagine there is not a huge mathematical difference between the highest expected, the top 1,500 highest expected value lineups on a 13-game baseball slate. In fact, they might even be like negligible EV differences. But the point is, and the ultimate thing is that the 1,500 lineups built when you build your lineups with SaberSim are not necessarily those top 1,500 lineups. And it's actually probably better thought that they are, I think approximating your lineups from SaberScore 100 to your lowest SaberScore lineup in your pool of 1,500 is probably better thought of as a rough, even spectrum of the maximum expected value lineup you can build on that slate to a neutral expected value lineup at the end, then it is assuming that those are very close to the top 1,500 lineups you could play. If they were the top 1,500 expected value lineups you could play, and you had the opportunity to just massively diversify and match your portfolio exactly to the percent chance that any given stack or player was optimal, then it would be a home run, right? It would be the dream, right? That's kind of the goal. But in reality, there is, I think, a material difference between expected value of the very top end lineups in your pool and the very low end lineups in your pool. Takes you down an interesting path pretty quickly, though. Two things that I kind of think of here, and I'm gonna ramble on this for a little bit here before I really get going. There's a 14 reply chain going on back and forth here a little bit in Slack. So if you're interested in what we're talking about here, I'd go read. It looks like Andrew and Mills have been talking about this a little bit in Slack as well. So I'd go read a little bit what these guys are talking about here. I'm just kind of giving my thoughts on this, but it's an interesting idea here. Anyway, what I was going to say is that so where we're at, right, is the pool of 1,500 lineups in your pool are viable, but probably not maximal. They're the maximum EV lineups possible, right? So sampling that has some issues with potentially playing bad lineups at purely to diversify, right? Well, there are ways to kind of circumvent that. I think there's a couple things that interesting come up. The first is, you know, build 1,500 lineups and chop off the bottom 500, right? Sample from your top 1,000, right? I think that's an interesting idea. Another one, I think, and probably a better idea here is to put more rules in front of the build. And Andrew hinted at this here as well, of making your adjustments in step one. I don't even think it's just step one. I think being more, defining more precisely what lineup constructions you want with build rules in step two and saying, you know, I don't want any lineups that don't have at least, a three stack in it, right, for baseball, or at least a four stack in it, will make the bottom lineups in your pool a little bit better as well. I think that's another option. I think there are ways to make that pool stronger, and the more work you can do to make that pool stronger ahead of time, the better it's going to be for randomly sampling there in step three. And I actually think, you know, there's an interesting argument to do this no matter how you're actually ultimately selecting your lineups, right? Like, if you know, that's kind of actually the root of why I always say, if you know how you want to tackle the slate before the build, tell us before the build, right? I would say, you know, making improvements to your lineup constructions with rules in step one or two ultimately is going to have a bigger impact on the bottom lineups by Saber score in your pool, right? That's not going to have a huge impact. The top lineups in your pool are always going to be probably very nicely correlated, highly projected, low owned lineups. But the bottom lineups in your pool are the ones that are likely to improve the more work you put in up front to force stacking rules in. Or to dial other things in like that. So I think that's another way to get around this here. I have toyed with this idea quite a bit. I've thought about going this kind of direction. And ultimately, I don't think it gives you enough of a benefit compared to the risks here of playing basically dead lineups. I think even if you wanted to play a very diversified strategy, I think you are probably still just better off making the adjustments to your exposures, to your player exposures, until you are appropriately diversified. Because what that will do is you'll get your cake and eat it too, right? You'll be able to diversify your exposures to exactly where you want them, but also still play the maximum Saber score lineups you can in every spot. And I think rather than randomly sampling your pool completely, you can just do that, right? Play the best lineups where your exposure is limited to any one set of players. So I would be interested to continue this conversation going. I know Andrew and Mills are talking in chat here. And if you guys have any other thoughts here for me while I'm live and on stream, that you want to kick around, I'm interested to talk about this a little bit further. I don't think I've read the entire thread myself, so I might be a little bit behind, but I guess to sum up this question, I do think it's an interesting idea. I think it's an interesting thought experiment. I've toyed with it a little bit myself. I value Saber score a little bit too highly to dive in there. If you wanted to experiment with that more, or experiment with the idea of just playing a broader pool to kind of force some diversity overall, I would do as much as you can. I would ask yourself, what are the kinds of lineups you want to see from all of the different tools that are at your disposal pre-built, right? Salary, construction, any groups or anything like that, right? Think about that ahead of time and apply that before the build to make that lineup pool as effective as possible for that, right? Because you are sacrificing the Saber score grading metric essentially by doing this. You were saying, I'm going to ignore that. And it is valuable, right? You can see it. I mean, again, I'll just say this, and this will be the last thing before we move on. You can see it very quickly just by looking at your entire pool from a build, right? We can come in here and see, you know, we have some small stacks here, right? I probably wouldn't play just like a naked four stack on a 13-game slate, personally. And we can see that they're here, right? Now, you know, anyway, I mean, they'd be randomly sampled. You could get them into your pool here. So, anyway, good question. Fun thing to think about here. And for now, let's move on. Okay. So Don asks an interesting question here. This one comes in pretty frequently. And then we'll move over to YouTube chat after this one. This is the last question in Slack. He said, in baseball, I'm typically in the top 10% early on, but as the slate continues, I end up totally out of the money. Should I purposely incorporate later games into my selection process? I wouldn't. This is mostly just like a cognitive bias of the way that the games play out. It feels as if you are losing money as the slate goes on, but it's basically just kind of a fact of the way that the games are ultimately laid out that, you know, some of the games have to happen first and some of the games have to happen later, right? And DraftKings actually, you know, you never actually have that money. DraftKings and FanDuel intentionally tell you how much you are winning at any point in the slate because it makes the sweat It makes the game more fun to play, right? You get that feeling of sweating, but you actually were never up, really, truthfully. The golf slate is a 4-day sweat, right? So I'm in the money right now. I am technically profitable, but the reality is I'm not. That the slate is in progress. It does not really matter, what time the golfers are teeing off and when they score their points. It's the same thing in baseball. I guess the point I'm really trying to make here is that game start time affects nothing quantifiable. A player is not projected better because of his start time. A player is not more correlated with his teammates because of his start time. I think maybe in a very, very unique case, there would be an argument to be made that a player might be lower owned because of his start time, right? Maybe a player with weather concerns in a late game, potentially, or something like that. But there's no real reason to intentionally focus on players playing in later games, especially in baseball, right? In basketball, it does get a little bit more interesting because I think, especially regular season NBA DFS, there's so much late swap opportunity. There's so much value in being able to late swap flexibly later in the slate that I actually think you can argue that there is a greater relative advantage to players playing in later games than there are in players playing in earlier games. I don't think that's the case in baseball. It is not as if, if we take, let's look. 4.5. Okay, it is not as if the Giants projected for 4.5 runs are a better overall team to stack than the Red Sox purely because they play 3 hours later. So the whole late game hammer thing that you hear around the industry in general, I think is just kind of a myth. It's just, it feels bad when you get caught late in the slate. But if all of the slates, if all the games started at the exact same time, the projections wouldn't change. If the game start times were randomized, the projections wouldn't change. There's no real reason to intentionally force exposure to later games in baseball DFS, I would say. So, but really good question. And I know it really, if you've ever been taking something down and then get caught, especially in baseball, that happens very easily just because a home run can change the slate completely. It certainly feels like you want some exposure to that late game, but I wouldn't force it. So, good question. All right, Eagles said, how does the MMA model take into effect guys that miss weight and short notice replacements? Yeah, good question here. So we will essentially take it into effect in the way that we take the Vegas odds into effect. So, we mentioned here, I'll summarize, first of all, a couple concepts here from a video that goes far more in depth into this. So if you want more detail into the way that our MMA sims are put together, I'd watch this. I had Will on here a month ago now. Will basically built our MMA sims. So, and he came on and talked in detail about how they're built. So I'm going to summarize some concepts here. And if by chance Will is watching or listening along here, anybody from the models team, and I misspeak, feel free to correct me at any point here. But my understanding of this here is that, as the Vegas odds adjust and resettle, we'll wait for things to kind of resettle, the Vegas odds end up being some of the primary inputs to our simulations. So we basically use them, convert them to implied probabilities, and those become the probabilities that dictate each individual sim. So I don't know MMA well enough to speak super intelligently on what the impact of a fighter missing weight is, or the differences between a new fighter getting plugged into a fight, a short notice replacement, that kind of thing. But we will adjust the way that we simulate that fight out in the way that the odds, the implied probabilities of the Vegas odds shake out. So if a fighter suddenly gets replaced and his opponent is a much weaker opponent and the inside the distance props now imply that he has a 20% greater chance of winning inside the distance, then that will be reflected in our most recent simulations. And typically, I think the final MMA sims will go Saturday morning-ish generally, and they'll be up. The one thing to look out for and to keep an eye out there is that, and this is kind of more conjecture on my part, is fighters, know who they're going to be fighting for a while, and they train to fight against a particular person. If that fighter is replaced, or maybe just comes in overweight or something like that, I think it does. I think there's a decent argument to be made that that increases the variance of the fight. The ranges of outcomes widen, especially in the case of a replacement, I think, right? There's just less, the fighters are less prepared for that fight at that point. And I think that would increase the range of outcomes. So, you know, I would probably be, I would be more interested on those fighters if they were lower owned, and a little less interested if they were higher owned. I think that that part is kind of where it gets a little bit more interesting from the strategic standpoint. But all of this, is to say, in summary here, is that we will update for this kind of thing. We will update as accurately as Vegas manages to update. So there are limitations to using Vegas odds and lines this fundamentally in a projection model, in a simulation model, that we're aware of, that we talked a little bit on that longer video as well. So, but we will basically update up to that point. And if you think that those Vegas lines are soft or did not properly think about how those two new fighters will actually fight each other, then I think it's a good opportunity to make some adjustments. As with everything, all sports, right? The best opportunities to make adjustments, I say this in all sports, are situations where it is inherently a cloudy or a murky or a difficult to project situation. And when you have, you know, two fighters who are fighting each other, I think opening lines for MMA fights open basically as soon as the last card ends. So you have these lines that you have financial markets for these fights that have been allowed to adjust for weeks, really, sometimes. And suddenly the fight changes and you're talking about sometimes maybe just a 24, 48, 72 hours of adjustment, right? Those lines have an opportunity to get there, but I don't think those markets are as efficient. So therefore they simulations probably are not as perfectly efficient. And I think it's a good opportunity to add value by making adjustments. Same deal within basketball, right? Yeah, we can project a team when the two star players go down with injury. But that is inherently a situation that becomes harder to project. And those are your best opportunities to make value with your own adjustments. So, but really good question there. Andrew said, when is the pod coming? It is, it's in progress. So we're working on that. I would say probably in the next week or so, hopefully. You know, didn't want to just phone it in with getting this up. So, we've been working to get the podcast up, get a backlog of some interesting past office hours and other stream episodes up there so that those are there as well for people, getting all the infrastructure set up so that it can be as effective and as automated as possible. So it's coming soon. Aaron said, how do you feel about setting a minimum percent in step one for baseball after running some research builds? I think that's great. I think that's perfectly fine. I think that's a good application for your research builds. What I would do if you were going that route is I would take some of those guys that after running the research build had positive leverage that looked like they were players you wanted to be over the field on, and maybe set their minimum exposure to their projected ownership. And match the and say at least match the field on these guys, maybe 1.5 or 2x the ownership if you want to play a little bit more aggressively. Lately, I've been working a little bit more with projections. So I've been bumping up teams, mostly teams, but sometimes individual players on teams that I feel like are going to be underowned or overowned. But I think the exposures work just fine as well. I think that's a really good way to apply what you find in your research builds. So. Scott said, how do you approach satellites? If you have 5 potential lineups, do you have 5 unique lineups or 5 of the same? Good question. I think if you were playing only satellites, wait, let me make sure I answer this question correctly. If you have 5 potential lineups, do you have 5 unique lineups or 5 of the same? Okay, got it. I typically choose to play kind of a scattergun strategy with satellites. And as opposed to trying to take down all 5 satellites with one lineup, I will just play a unique lineup into each. That's my approach in general. I think they are already very high variance contests where many of them are essentially just winner take alls, where you have a big prize up at first and, you know, very little or nothing going to second. I don't need to introduce even more variance into that by playing my top lineup into every single satellite. Even if that is maybe like the slightest bit higher EV. So I typically prefer to play a unique lineup in virtually every satellite I'm playing. There's a point where I wouldn't want to go much further than that, obviously, right? You know, if you were playing, I think there's two situations where I would maybe tone that down a little bit. One is if you were playing a ton of different satellite entries, right? Anytime I start ending up being over 150 or so unique lineups for a slate, that is typically when I will stop playing uniques, just because I think managing more than 150 lineups starts to be a lot. Secondly, is if there was a significant difference in stakes, right? If you were playing a live qualifier contest and also a 10-cent contest to win a $15 ticket, I don't know if I'd be comfortable leaving it up to pure chance what lineup that my lineup ended up in that particular case. So I might, you know, play some of the same lineups in both in that particular case. But average, you know, broadly speaking, I think I'd prefer to play a unique lineup in each satellite. So. Aaron said, so you're saying don't stack the first NBA game on the slate and have one guy in the late game. I think that's really where it gets. I think the application of this late swap flexibility for NBA is where this conversation starts to get really interesting. And in fact, somebody asked me a couple weeks ago here, like, what is the biggest thing I learned this season in NBA? Which is actually a super interesting question. Or maybe it was like, what is the thing I want to add next year? Something like that. Really cool question. And what I'd said is getting a little bit sharper with the way I handle late swap flexibility. And I don't know if I'd want to do something like this, like blindly cross off the first games on the slate, or blindly force exposure to the late games. I'm not sure yet. I do think it does require a little bit of care, because if there are elite plays in the early games in the slate, those plays do still have value, right? Random February 4th slate. Let's take a look here, right? Second best overall value play on the slate, Troy Brown Jr. playing in the first game, 7.5x, right? Now, probably, you know, less relative value than James Johnson or Sengun, who are playing in later games, or Sengun. I always pronounce his name wrong, right? But still a valuable player in his own right. You don't want to just, I typically, you know, it's the same deal with how I approach ownership most of the time. I don't want to blindly fade the chalk. I want to play the chalk accordingly, adjusting them correctly for how owned they are going to be to the field. Right? Similar deal here. I don't want to blindly fade all the players playing in this early game. I want to play them accordingly, knowing that I sacrifice opportunity to swap later. So I'm pretty excited. Not really a lot of opportunities to do that here in the NBA playoffs, but I'm pretty excited already for the start of next season to do that a little bit more and to experiment with ways of calculating the late swap flexibility here that you get from players playing in later games intelligently. And it works on the late games too as well, right? So like, for example, let's say there were two late games for this slate, right? Now, I think all four of these teams playing in these games have an increased relative advantage, right? Because they are players in late games, right? By rostering these players at lock, you preserve flexibility later in the slate to swap. But let's say, just for example, that Portland had two questionable players, right? And two questionable players projected very well, actually. Their fantasy points actually probably even have more relative advantage than just the other three teams playing in the same time window, because this is the team that is questionable, right? So these guys are more valuable because their probability of a player getting ruled out in their game, that's basically what we're banking on, the probability of a questionable player getting ruled out. So that's another thing I kind of want to look at, is what I don't know, and I don't know how we'll do it, but I actually don't even want to say we'll do it, because I don't know if this is something that I'm thinking about more for my process than maybe something that would actually come in as like a feature at the moment. But what I've been kind of thinking is like a percentage of playable minutes that are questionable. What percentage of projectable minutes are currently questionable for a team? And then how does that change the way that team is valued throughout the slate? And then also combine that with the start time, right? Higher percentage of questionable minutes playing in a later game is increased value to the players playing on that team. But I'm excited to play with that a little bit. So, Katie said, is there a way to easily spread out baseball stacks when running 150 lineups? For instance, I don't want 10 combos of the same two teams. I would like only three combos of the same two teams. So good question here. So I will say, are the current tools we have to do this in a very explicit way and say, you know, lower my exposure to this combination are kind of limited. It's something we want to add. It's something we want to improve, but at the moment they are a little bit, it's a little bit clunky. It's a little bit limited. So I'll show you how I would go about doing this instead, or not even so much how I would go about doing this, but how I would think about this. The first thing is, if you want to increase the diversity of your lineups, one of the best things I think you could do is increase the sim variance slider, right? Like, let's say you are getting at sim variance five, let's say you are getting an uncomfortable amount of combinations of Braves and Yankee stacks, right? Which may actually happen. Those are two very highly projected teams, right? Well, as you increase the sim variance slider, you are using a smaller and smaller set of simulations to build each lineup. So the raw probability, the raw likelihood of the two best stacks to use in that lineup being the Braves and Yankees goes down, right? Or you can think about this also from a pitcher and stack combination or any different combinations. Just the probability of those players being the best plays goes down as sim variance increases. So I think one of the best ways to increase the diversity of your lineups overall is to just increase the sim variance slider. And especially, I've been even playing some slates where this is up at 10. I think you will find that that is definitely a pretty, I would say that's a pretty diversifying tool. Another option, especially if you're already working with a very high sim variance slider, is to increase the number of minimum uniques you have in your lineup. Now, this is a little weird with baseball because of the way that you're stacking these players together, right? Minimum uniques is really applied on the player level, but I do think it will still have a pretty good impact to diversify your lineups by increasing this to two or even three, potentially, if you're finding that your lineups are still not very well diversified. So I would start there. The last thing I'll note is if you are playing, so when you're building 150, I think the best tools at your disposal are going to be turning up that sim variance slider and maybe exploring playing with a higher minimum unique setting because you have so many lineups. If you have only 20 or so, I do think you can do a little bit more cherry picking here and do something like using the filters to filter away certain combinations. So in this case, let's see our Cubs, 60% Cubs. And let's say we have a lot of Cubs stacks paired with St. Louis, and we don't want that many, right? We can go in here and uncheck some of these lineups from our pool and just remove a couple to even out that potential exposure there. And then fill these back up with other lineups from the pool. Now, this is pretty painful to do for every combination if you're playing a lot of different lineups. So I don't ever do this playing like 150, but I do think if you're playing just a few lineups, that can be a good way to do it. But I think the best approaches here would be to turn up that sim variance slider and turn up the minimum uniques. And that should help with getting those more diversified lineups. In the future, our goal, and this is, it's a difficult technical problem to solve, but our goal is to make you be able to filter by any combination here and say, you know, for example, Cubs and St. Louis stacks, and just turn down the exposure of that combination. At the moment, when you filter, so if we, let's do another example here. Let's filter by Mets and Reds, which seem to be another combination where we have a lot of exposure. If you turn down either of these exposures, it just ends up getting applied globally. It doesn't really actually have the impact that you might think it would here. But in the future, we want to be able to add, we want to add the way to do that in a way that, you know, works a little more intuitively. So hopefully that was helpful. I know options are a little bit limited for now, but I do think you will find that this turning up sim variance and turning up min unique should help a lot. So Matt said, piggybacking off Katie's question, I think a while ago you said you didn't like more than 40% pitchers and 30% of batters for exposure. How would that translate to 20 maxes? Yeah, so I for 20 maxes, I'm typically comfortable with more exposure, like across the board. I don't know if I have as much of just a general rule of thumb for these. When I'm playing just 20, to be completely honest, I'm a little bit more comfortable, like kind of rolling with what I get by default. If I'm getting 50, 60% exposure to a player in 20 maxes, I'm okay with it. Cause again, remember it's only 10 or 12 or so lineups, right? The difference is, you know, you're talking about 60% exposure in 150 lineups is what, 90 lineups with that player in it, right? There's a big difference. Even though I think, you know, commonly people think like, oh, MME, 20 maxes and 150 maxes. There's really a huge difference in the number of lineups there when you're talking about exposures. So I still play pretty spread out when I play 20 maxes. I wouldn't say I'm very condensed on most players. I don't have a rule of thumb as much here as well as that works as well for the 20 maxes. I guess if I had to spit out a number, the one that comes to mind is about 60%. It gets my attention if there's a player that's coming in like 100% on baseball 20 maxes, or well over 60%. And that's, you know, you'll see typically that's kind of where the line ends up getting drawn. The other thing to note here too, is it is a little bit dependent on ownership. 13 game slate ownership is going to be a little weird tonight. Like probably what is likely to happen, I think, is there'll probably be three or four teams. I think probably both Coors teams and probably the Yankees and the Braves, it seems like, I think at the moment. And they actually will have like some material ownership. Like they will, let's see. This is what I'm expecting to happen. You'll typically have on these big slates, you'll have a few teams. Oh, the Dodgers maybe too, right? Coors, total's dropping at Coors quite a bit. Interesting. It'll be an interesting slate tonight here. I think what's likely to happen is you'll probably have a few teams where there's like measurable, noticeable ownership on it. And then every other team will have ownership like this. Like nobody's, like every other team is stackable. You can stack, you can do whatever else you want. But on a normal slate or on a slate that's like an 8 or a 9 game slate, I might adjust that for ownership a little bit as well. Like I might be comfortable having 60% exposure to a stack if they're the chalkier stack and I just want to be over the field on them. If it's some really low projected contrarian stack, maybe I cap those hitters at 20%, even in 20 lineups. So it is a little bit ownership adjusted as well. But I'm less picky overall with my 20 maxes just because there's less lineups in play. With my 150 maxes, it's very important to be conscious of when you are committing big chunks of those lineups to certain assets. You know, if you're committing 90 unique lineups to one player, that is a lot. That is a big investment. So I'm more opinionated there. But Daniel said, how many slates have had the winner winning before the last games? Bet it's pretty negative EV to not at least have one hammer. I don't think so. I would disagree with that. There's not really any. Now, okay, I want to be careful about the way I answer this question. I don't think the conclusion here follows from what you've presented, right? So there is a last game to be played that night, right? So like that game exists. It is a part of the slate, right? So I mean, I think you could ask yourself, I think this would, what would be a better question that would demonstrate or prove this more would be to ask, is there a bigger difference? Are there more lineups that are lineups more likely to lose that fade the last game completely than are more likely to lose if they fade any other arbitrary game on the slate, right? Is there any reason to believe that by fading the Nationals and Giants game completely, you are more likely to lose than some other similarly projected or to be scientific about it, identically projected game? Right. Or is there actually, if this game suddenly got moved up to 6:15 PM for some reason or another, do the projections of that player change? Right. The answer I think has to be no, unless somebody can tell me why this game start time actually affects what is likely to happen in the game. Right. Now, with that said, because it is a game on the slate and chronologically, it is the last game of the slate. Right. As there are players that score points in that game, the lineups that have those players in them can only move up. It is always going to feel as if that game was like, oh, I needed to have this game. But that's a cognitive bias. That is not a factor that's actually making that game a more positive expected value decision to play it. So, you know, with that said, there's so many different ways to stack up a baseball slate. If you want a late game hammer, I would say just do it. Right? Like, I mean, you can basically play whoever you want anyway. So if you don't want to be, you know, sweating these last games, right? If you want to be chasing and not being chased for the last games, then get some exposure to the late games because it probably doesn't hurt you. You know, sport like basketball can, right? Players are more likely to score near their average projection. I think those average projections are a better indicator of success. There are more wrong ways to go when you're playing basketball DFS. Blindly stacking up late games in basketball, I think, is a bad idea without some eye to the slate. For baseball, I think if you really want to, you can. But I would strongly disagree that it is actually negative EV to build a lineup that doesn't have a late game hammer, because game start time does not influence projections. It just doesn't. So Dante says, Jordan, is it better to limit the builder to stacks I know I want for sure, or just get rid of them in step three? Also, is lowering ownership viable if I make adjustments to ownership projections? Okay, let's start with the first question. If you know what stacks you want, if you are 100% confident about the stacks you want to see in your lineups, I would either limit your player pool, or probably even better yet, I would set a stacking rule that forces the builder to respond and follow those. You will get a better pool in step three that better matches what you are trying to do than without it, right? Here's a good example. Let's say you build 1,500 lineups. And because of all of the lineups that were built with stacks that you don't want, after you go through and eliminate all of those, now you only have 1,000 lineups left. Well, in reality, that's as if you just built with a 1,000 lineup pool, right? You lose the advantage of having the other 500 lineups in there. But if you set the rule ahead of time, that entire 1,500 lineup pool is built the way you want, or at least partially. So now you have 1,500 lineups to work from. So if you know for sure, set it beforehand. Tell us beforehand. Second question here, is lowering ownership viable if I'm making adjustments to the ownership projections? I wouldn't, personally. So if you're adjusting the ownership projections and presumably doing so in a way that's accurate or at least directionally correct, right? You're not making mistakes. You're actually like making good adjustments to the ownership projections. I think that is a better argument to having the ownership fade slider higher, or at least where it is by default, right? Turning down the ownership fade slider basically says two things. It says on one hand, I want to value ownership less, but on the other, it's also saying I am less confident about the ownership numbers, right? So as your confidence in your ownership projections increases, I think that is a better argument to having a higher ownership fade. I probably wouldn't go too crazy with this. I wouldn't like increase this very much, but if you're going to spend the time adjusting the ownership numbers, I do think you can get a little bit more out of that by at least leaving it where it is, or maybe making it like one tick higher, because you've spent the time to research ownership and make adjustments there. You might as well value that a little bit more. So Dawn says, I found that with teams with projected scores of five or more, I will tend to stack five players. Your thoughts? Yeah, that makes sense. I mean, that five, especially in April baseball, a team with a run total of five is probably going to be one of the best projected teams on the slate. In the heat of the summer, we get to July, August. You'll see slates where five implied runs is not as high as some of the other teams on the slate. We'll get some six, maybe seven or so implied run totals. At the moment, though, an implied run total of five is a lot, and it's probably going to be the highest run totals on the slate. So it does make sense that those would be your biggest stacks, right? Because those are the players, those teams are full of players with high upside potential, the highest expected run totals, the highest expected scoring outcomes. So I think it does, you know, there's other factors there, right? Ownership becomes a factor, pricing becomes a factor, but it makes sense that the builder, left to its own devices and especially like ownership agnostic, would want to stack up the teams with the highest run totals. So Daniel said, ownership changes, I think, due to time. People want fast points. Yeah, it does. I don't think that has a huge impact. There's always going to be the screenshot chasers, where people are stacking up the first game so that they can take a screenshot of them winning right after the games lock. I don't think that has an exploitable difference on ownership projections for a slate, right? I don't think that gives you anything. I don't think there's enough people to do that it makes it more profitable to stack up later games. But Yeah. I mean, there's always going to be a few people doing that. So maybe there is, but I'd be interested to see, you know, I mean, even like, so there's an interesting, let me see real quick here. We'll pull this down. This guy doesn't do this every night. Let me pull up this. Hang on. I'm pulling up a Twitter. So just give me a second. I got to remember what this guy's name is. Where is he? Okay, this guy. Pull this back up. Okay, so the Sports Projections Twitter here. He has actually a pretty cool site, has a lot of tools, different things on a site, but one of the things that he's been posting here, okay, so he's been posting these, right? And I think you can just do this on his site. I don't know, you might have to pay for it. But he breaks down, if you upload a contest CSV, he'll say, you know, how much, like how much, what are the stacks used by the field here. And one thing that has been nice to see from this when he posts these here is that there's still a lot of the field not stacking at all, which is always very encouraging to see. Stacking is has always been a big edge in baseball DFS, but as more people just kind of blindly do it, it does come down a little bit. But I would be interested to see, you know, and maybe this is just something to look into. Do early or late teams, or actually, I guess specifically what I would be interested to see is that is there a trend that teams playing at one time or the other are higher owned than others, right? Are early teams more likely to be owned? Are late teams more likely to be owned? And ideally, the way you would do this would be a scientific way of controlling for all other constants, which would be really hard to do. Like, you would want to control for probably their Vegas totals and the salary of those players, which gets really hard to do. I think you could kind of just approximate it with like maybe a game start time analysis, or maybe compare it to like some kind of aggregate ownership projection, and say, you know, treat an aggregate ownership projection as fact, and say that this is a factual approximation of how much this stack should be owned or how much these players should be owned, and then compare that and to what time the player's game starts. I think that might be interesting. But my gut is telling me that there is not enough difference in the way a player's actual ownership comes out based on their game start time that it's exploitable. I wish that it was. I dearly wish 10% of the field was stacking up the first games on the slate or something like that to try to snap screenshots. But yeah. So Daniel said, I follow that account. What an amazing site. Yeah, he has cool tools for sure. I should probably start experimenting with them a little bit more even. But he has some cool stuff. So Zachary said, how many lines do you crunch when building 150? Sometimes I want to force chalkier stacks. If you crunch too little, you are constantly adding more to the pool, but too much can create less likely outcomes. I always build 1500 personally. That's what I've been doing. For baseball, you typically always have plenty of time, right? Like, I'll start my baseball process like a half hour before lock. Sometimes I'll finish 10, 15 minutes before lock, which sounds crazy after basketball season, where you're always right up against lock. But since I have so much time to get that in, I will just build 1,500 just so I have them. It's not every slate that I need to use my entire pool of 1,500. It's not every slate where I'm making ownership or exposure adjustments in step three anyway. But it can't hurt, right? All you're doing when you're building 1500 is just giving you more, you're putting more lineups in the pool, right? I guess that's literally what you're doing. You're giving yourself more tools. You're giving yourself more options, right? All of those lineups are going to be graded by Sabre score anyway. So the likelihood of building a bad lineup because you built more lineups isn't a huge risk, assuming that you're still allowing Sabre score to sort those lineups and grade those lineups, right? Like, yes, as you build more and more lineups, the exposure of the worst projected teams on the slate is likely to come up a little bit higher and higher and higher because, you know, like, you simply can't build 10,000 lineups, for example, and have a massive exposure or a massive proportion of those lineups be Yankee stacks or the highest implied team total on the slate. Because the outcomes are so wide that as that number increases, right, that the exposure your lineups that include players from bad teams, so-called bad teams, is going to go up. But I don't think that makes your pool worse, at least at, not at the numbers that we have. So I always build 1500, but that's also because most of the time I'm playing 150, but it looks like you're playing 150 here too, reading the question back. So if you're playing 150, I would say just build 1500 and call it a day and don't overthink it. But all right. Good question. I don't see any other questions coming in here. Looks all quiet here. It was a fun stream today. I had some interesting conversations going on here. We talked a little bit about your lineup pool, the value of Saber Score, potentially omitting Saber Score completely and just unique filling from your entire lineup pool completely. We talked a little bit about stacks. We talked about stack sizing and stacking lower batting order position players in your lineups. Talked a little bit about how MMA sims adjust for breaking news, satellite contests. We talked about late swap flexibility in NBA, which I'm super excited to continue to dive into a little bit deeper as next season gets going here. All kinds of stuff. So it was a good stream. So thank you for everybody that tuned in here. We'll go ahead and probably close it off right there. I'll be right back here again next week on Monday. Same time, same place, 2 p.m. Eastern. So come join me here again next week. If you are watching along or have enjoyed this stream and haven't already signed up for SaberSim, come check us out. SaberSim.com, free 7 days, no strings attached. If you hate it, you try it, you don't like it, you can always cancel. We won't charge your card, but hopefully you like it, and hopefully you can come watch some more Office Hours streams while you have that trial and follow along with what I'm doing here. So come check us out there. Good luck in the 13-game mega slate tonight. Good luck in the NBA showdown if you're playing that. Enjoy any DFS and whatever else you're playing or doing this weekend, and I'll see you guys all on Monday. So until then, take care. See ya.